These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age, Part 2. The lecturer is Professor Jeremy McInerney. Professor McInerney received his Ph.D. from the University of California at Berkeley in 1992. Since 1992, he has been teaching Greek history at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is currently an associate professor in the Department of Classical Studies and serves as chair of the graduate group in the Art and Archaeology of the Mediterranean World. Professor McInerney also serves on the managing committee of the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. He has excavated in Israel, at Corinth, and on Crete. His research interests include topography, epigraphy, and historiography. Each of Professor McInerney's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, and bibliography. You might find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 13, The Greek Novel.
Welcome back to our 13th lecture now in the series on Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic World. We have had an opportunity in previous lectures to move away from the political history of the Hellenistic Age after Alexander the Great had conquered much of what had been the Persian Empire, and we've now had an opportunity to look at the cultural developments of the period. And what we've been stressing is that the 19th century view of Hellenism, the Hellenistic Age as a period of decadence, a culture that couldn't measure up to the heights of the classical period, is really an incorrect way of seeing the age. And what we've been trying to chart in the cultural history of the Hellenistic period is a great ferment and a great vitality in the work of artists working in different genres and different spheres. So that, for example, in the realm of sculpture, we've been able to see how Hellenistic sculptors moved beyond the classical ideal with its Olympian perfection and its figure of distant gods and heroes, and was able to grapple with real people and to show the old and the ugly and the infirm and the twisted, exploring a kind of Baroque mentality, vigorously interested in all aspects of life and expression. And we've also seen in the poetry of the age that similarly the artists moved off in new directions, writing interesting works for the courts of the Hellenistic kings, such as their idyllic pastoral poetry, but also infusing the epic with a whole new sensibility in the case of Apollonius, and exploring the interior life of individual men and women, psychological works, if you will. In the area of literature, the Hellenistic world is responsible for another remarkable innovation, and it's what I'd like to talk about today. It's the genre known as the Greek novel or the Greek romance. Now, customarily, we think of novels as being a European art form that really developed from the Renaissance and later into the modern period. And we might go back to, say, Cervantes' Don Quixote or the English novel. We might read early novels such as Moll Flanders. And it often comes as a surprise to people to find out that the Greeks, more than 1,500 years before the modern European novel, had been writing works that really fit into the same genre. When I say novel, or romance in this instance also, I'm referring to long works, hundreds of pages, written in prose. And these are stories that are full of adventures, they are set in the contemporary world, and they're particularly valuable for us to study because they give us a unique insight into the spirit of the Hellenistic Age. The reason I say that is that these novels were widely read and immensely popular. And the concerns that they express, the themes that crop up in these novels time and again, are the concerns and the themes of the age itself. Now, first of all, just a pedantic note, I should add that most of these novels actually come to us from the Roman period, that is to say, after the end of the period BC and into the period we commonly term AD. And yet we can still refer to them as Hellenistic in the sense that the political transition at the end of the Hellenistic Age, with the coming of Rome and the establishment of Roman provinces in the East, did not end the Greek culture that had already been established there by Alexander and his successors. So even though chronologically I'm referring to works that often date from the 1st and 2nd century AD, they are certainly Hellenistic in spirit, Hellenistic in feel, if you will, Hellenistic in setting, usually, and are an insight into the culture of the Greek East in both the Hellenistic and in the Roman periods. Well, there are five novels that people read most commonly, and I'd like to begin by just outlining who wrote these, when they date to, and what they deal with, and then we'll look in more detail at the themes and the substance of these various novels. The first one that we have was written by an author named Caratone of Aphrodisias. Aphrodisias, a beautiful city in southern Asia Minor, which flourished under the Romans. And he entitled his story Callirrhoe, though like many of the Hellenistic romances, it really should be named for both Callirrhoe, the heroine, and her lover, Chaereas. It's a story of star-crossed lovers, if you will. It is written towards the end of the 1st century BC, as best we can tell, though it's an interesting work because it's actually set dramatically at the very end of the 5th and the beginning of the 4th century BC. So it is really the first historical novel, as well as being a romance. It begins and ends at Syracuse, the Greek city located on Sicily, but in the course of their adventures, the lovers move as far east as Babylon, so that it incorporates the geography of the entire eastern Mediterranean, as well as regions inland too. The second of the novels that we have is written by an author called Xenophon, not to be confused with Xenophon, the student of Socrates and the author of the Anabasis, the March Up Country, but rather another Xenophon, whose tale is sometimes called the Tale of Anthea and Habrocomes, and is also referred to quite often as the Ephesian Tale, because it is set around the city of Ephesus, again on the eastern side of the Aegean and smack bang in the middle of the realm that we would regard as being the geographic center of the Hellenistic world, namely the Aegean and the eastern Mediterranean. It's a work that has many of the common elements that we find in the Hellenistic romances. It has two young lovers. They will be separated and they will eventually be joined again. In their travails, they are often attacked by pirates. They're subjected to shipwrecks, and eventually true love will conquer. And this theme of young lovers being challenged, being torn apart, and then being brought back together again is probably the most common theme, the most common plot line, really, running through the Hellenistic romances. The third novel that we have is written by an author named Achilles Tatius. He is particularly interesting because after trying his hand at one of these Hellenistic romances, the story of another pair of star-crossed lovers, Clitophon and Leucippe, Achilles Tatius, according to tradition after this, then became a Christian and finally a bishop. So everyone in the Hellenistic world and then later in the Roman world was in on the act of writing these Hellenistic romances. By far the best known of all the Hellenistic romances, a work that exerted an enormous influence on later writers, particularly in France and in England to a certain extent, is the novel written by Longus, known as Daphnis and Chloe. We know absolutely nothing about the author aside from his name, but the novel really is one of the most remarkable works that one will read in any language. For a start, it's remarkable because of its treatment of the sexual awakening of its young protagonists, Daphnis and Chloe. And the way in which the work deals with this is particularly interesting because at times it is almost coy, at other times it is ironic, at certain times it is quite gentle, and at other times it's almost mocking and humorous. This was written for a sophisticated audience, despite its wide popularity. It was written for people who understood allusions to other works written by Greek authors at earlier periods of Greek history, and authors working in a range of different genres, so that there are mock allusions, for example, to Thucydides' history, and there are certainly references to Hellenistic pastoral poetry. In fact, Daphnis and Chloe come together as a result of a kind of competition between Daphnis and another shepherd, in just the same manner as we've seen competitions between shepherds in the Theocritean pastoral poems that we've looked at in other lectures. So it's a work that alludes to other genre, both of earlier Greek literature and of contemporary literature as well. We'll return to it in a moment. The fifth of the Hellenistic romances, the well-known Hellenistic romances, is that of Heliodorus, and it is a work entitled The Ethiopian Story. Like all the other novels, it again deals with a story of a pair of star-crossed lovers, and like the other works, it has these digressions thrown in, subplots, so that the lovers are separated at various points, and the action then moves from different parts of the Hellenistic world, such as Delphi and Egypt, into areas like Ethiopia, the exotic outer margins of the Hellenistic world. This common phenomenon of these works as, in a way, fictional travel logs, I think suggests the fascination of the Hellenistic world with the new geographic realities of the age. That is that Hellenism, Greek settlers, had moved way beyond the eastern Mediterranean, and so there were many areas which the Greeks had known about for hundreds of years, but only really as romantic names, the Amazons, the Indians, the Ethiopians. But now we're having writers giving their audience a romantic story that includes these areas, partly to spice up the story and to pique the interest of people who found the outer regions of the Hellenistic world exotic and fascinating. The novels share many motifs and patterns, and there is a common outlook that runs through each of them, and that is quite simply the unpredictability of life. And it's this theme which I think runs through Hellenistic culture and is typified by these stories. The stories all concern young lovers, and the stories are all what we would term adventures. So they're there to entertain people, but they're also there to express an anxiety widely felt in the Hellenistic age, that the scale of things was so large, that the geographic spread of things was so large, that the old certainties were gone, that life was no longer simply a matter of a small city-state or a small village, that you could be abducted by pirates, that your life could change in a moment's notice, that you could end up living hundreds of miles, thousands of miles away from the place where you're actually born. So people have sometimes said that the Hellenistic age is a little like our age in the sense that there is a greater sense of rootlessness, as if people are not as connected as they had been generations earlier to the same familiar places. Sex, in various forms, lurks beneath the surface of many of the stories. Sometimes it's the sexual awakening of the couple, which can be treated quite gently or quite humorously, but at other times it's a much more violent expression. Often it's the threat of rape of the heroine, or it may be the rough sexual initiation of the young man in the couple. And I think in exploring this, what the Hellenistic novelists are doing is something that we've seen already in the work of Apollonius. They're trying to explore the human soul when it's in moments of great emotion, heightened emotion, when human beings are facing experiences for the first time that they've never faced before. And so, for example, in Longus's Daphnis and Chloe, much of the first book deals with the circumstances around the first kiss between the young lovers and the response that they have to this. Here is what Daphnis has to say in an interior monologue after he has finally kissed his beautiful young girlfriend, who eventually he'll marry, Chloe. And he says, "Whatever is Chloe's kiss doing to me? Her lips are softer than roses, and her mouth is sweeter than honey, but her kiss hurts more than the sting of a bee. I've often kissed kids, And I've often kissed newborn puppies and the calf that Dorkon gave her, but this kiss is something quite new. My breath's coming in gasps, my heart's jumping up and down, my soul's melting away. But all the same, I want to kiss her again. Oh, what an unlucky victory. And what a strange disease. I don't even know what to call it. Had Chloe drunk poison just before she kissed me? If so, how did she manage not to be killed? Hear how the nightingales are singing and my pipe is silent. Look how the kids are frisking about and I'm sitting still. Look how the flowers are blooming. And I'm not making any garlands. Yes, the violets and the hyacinths are in flower, but Daphnis is withering away. Is Dorkon going to seem better looking than I am after all? So he's emotionally overwhelmed by this experience of the first time of kissing a girl, trying to understand what's happened to him. And it's this kind of interior monologue that's so reminiscent of the passage that we saw earlier in Apollonius's Argonautica, when he was describing the passion that Medea feels for Jason. So the novel, like Apollonius's epic poetry, displays the Hellenistic world's fascination with art being a vehicle now for expressing the interior emotional life of human beings, of trying to chart that interior life and to explore it and to give artistic expression to it. Related to this, as we've seen before, is an interest in extreme states of mind. We charted this particularly in the lecture on Hellenistic sculpture, where we saw the artists almost torturing some of their figures as they are in contortion and as they're feeling terrible pain. So too, the novels give us men and women who are pushed to the brink of emotional torment. This is graphically expressed in Caratone's work. It's graphically expressed in Achilles Tatius's work, when at one point a Greek general by the name of Charmides, who has fallen in love with Leucippe, has been trying to press his claim on her, and the reaction that she has is one that is so physically overwhelming that she actually is thrown into a fit. And in typical fashion for a Hellenistic novelist, Achilles Tatius will give a graphic description of this. We were still looking for a plan when a man rushed in, greatly disturbed, and told us that Leucippe, while walking abroad, had suddenly fallen down, her eyes rolling. So we jumped up and ran to her and found her lying on the ground. I went up to her and asked her what was the matter, but no sooner had she seen me than her eyes, all bloodshot, she struck me in the face. And when Menelaus tried to constrain her, she kicked him. This made us understand that she was afflicted with some kind of madness, so we forcibly seized her and tried to hold her. She struggled against us, however, and cared nothing about what a woman doesn't want to be seen. So she's thrashing around and her clothes are coming up and they can see her naked. As a result, a great hubbub arose in the tent so that the general found himself hurried in and saw what was happening. At first he suspected that this illness of hers was but a pretense against his advances and looked suspiciously at Menelaus. When he saw the truth, as he soon did, he too grieved and felt pity for her. And eventually, of course, she will recover from this. So, with her bloodshot eyes and with her thrashing, she appears to be possessed by a kind of madness. It's almost the language that we would expect describing a priestess who has been possessed by the god at Delphi, for example. So traditionally this kind of possession is a religious ecstasy, but now it's being presented here not as an affliction from the gods, because the gods wish to speak through us as an oracle, but a human condition, the reaction of a woman who is trying to resist the advances of a man who she doesn't like. A common theme of the novels is the unpredictability of life. And in the novels, this is often suggested by the plot device of having pirates suddenly appear out of nowhere. In Xenophon's Ephesian tale, for example, the hero, Habrocomes, and his girlfriend, Anthea, are happily sailing along from Rhodes to Ephesus when our hero has a dream in which a huge woman, clothed in scarlet, sets fire to the ship that he's sailing on. And she, in fact, represents Tyche, or as the Romans would later call her, Fortuna. She is the spirit who has come to tell him that his life is about to take a drastic turn for the worse. And of course, what the dream portends, in fact, is a pirate attack the very next day. Just when things are going along well, you never know when change is going to happen. Now, this, of course, had been a theme in Greek literature for many years. There was the well-known story in Herodotus about Polycrates, the tyrant of Samos, who was so fortunate that he wanted to avert disaster by actually causing himself misfortune. He'd taken his gold ring off, thrown it into the water, only to find a fisherman bring a fish to table a few days later with the gold ring inside, a sign from the gods that he couldn't avert the misfortune awaiting him by trying to create his own misfortune. So the Greeks have had for a long time a notion of the mutability of life, the unpredictability of life. But in the Hellenistic age, this becomes a veritable fixation. People were clearly worried that at any moment their stable, prosperous lives could be overturned. They might be killed or carted off by pirates, sold at market, and end their life as a slave in someone else's household. And when one considers, in fact, the hundreds of thousands of people who did move from the eastern Mediterranean to Rome as a result of Rome's conquests, it's not an anxiety that was unreasonable. Many people did begin life happy, secure, and prosperous, and ended up slaves hundreds of miles away from where they'd been born. During the scene of carnage as the pirates attack Hebrocomes and Anthea, one of the captives declares, "Blessed are those who will happily die before they become slaves to robbers." And that's not just merely a literary line. I think that is an expression of a genuine anxiety of many, many people. Frequently, the human actors in these stories believe that the gods have acted capriciously. The gods really don't care about them at all. And that they, the humans, have no control over their lives whatsoever. This anxiety, again, is not merely a story device or a plot device. It's a real expression of anxiety. This was an age in which every household had a small shrine and where people had charms that they carried with them to avert ill fortune and where people tried to place curses on their opponents, on their enemies, little lead tablets which they would wrap up and drop into a well. It is a suspicious age and people don't know whether the old traditional gods are still on their side anymore or not. When Chaereas sees the tomb of his beloved Callirhoe empty, he cries, "Which of the gods is my rival for Callirhoe and has spirited her away and keeps her against her will, forced by a stronger fate?" Forced by a stronger fate. That could be almost a tagline summarizing the Hellenistic age and its attitude towards the gods and towards destiny. The novels reflect a world of terrible uncertainty. The gods cannot be relied upon. There's a very interesting moment parallel to this in the actual history of the age, not in the literary history, when Demetrius Poliorcetes, one of the great generals of the Hellenistic age, arrives in Athens in the 290s. And as he arrives, the Athenians greet him by saying, "You indeed are a god, because you are here." Whereas the other gods either don't hear us, or they've gone away, or they don't exist. So traditional faith was very much under threat at the time as people felt the stability of an earlier age evaporating beneath them. The gods cannot be relied upon. Although they do communicate to us in oracles and dreams, their intentions are frequently mysterious. We can't be sure what these mean. And so often we could be the victims as much as the beneficiaries of their involvement in the world of humanity. The narrator of Callirhoe declares, for example, "Against fortune alone, human reason is powerless. She is like a spirit who likes to win." So fortune is not there to aid us, but manipulates our lives, and we can never tell whether we're going to have a good destiny or a bad one. These novels that we've been looking at are linked in the way that they reflect the contemporary world. The novels are confined to the world of the Eastern Mediterranean, from Syracuse in Sicily and to Alexandria, and occasionally move beyond that. But the places that are beyond the Mediterranean realm still tend to be fantasy realms. In other words, the Greeks are still thinking of the Mediterranean as their world. And even though we've seen Greek colonies going as far east as Icanum, and we've seen these Bactrian kingdoms, in a way, the Greeks never lose this sense that they are really tied to the Mediterranean, so that any people who aren't a part of the Mediterranean world are automatically fantastic, are automatically exotic and weird. The only area in which non-Greek cultures are represented in these romances at all is in the area of religion. And even here, it's a Hellenized religion in which figures like Isis have been assimilated to Aphrodite. We've already seen in our lecture on Ptolemaic Egypt the way in which the Ptolemaic kings attempted to take a pre-existing cult, to give it a Greek packaging, and then to sell it, as it were, to the rest of the Mediterranean. Well, I think the novels give us an illustration of how successful this was. The Greeks did look at other religions, but they weren't interested in other religions for their foreignness. They were interested in these to the extent that they could understand them as Greek-like cults. So that Isis in the Hellenistic age, though originally, of course, an Egyptian goddess, is really, to all intents and purposes, a Greek goddess. What I'm suggesting here is that by looking at not only what is in the novels, but what is excluded from the novels, we get yet further evidence for the basic phenomenon of the Hellenistic world, and that is a lack of cultural fusion. These novels do not represent non-Greek and Greek cultures assimilating each other. Rather, they represent a Greek world which is fundamentally uninterested in anything outside the Mediterranean, anything which is non-Greek. So when non-Greeks do appear in these stories, they nearly always appear as characters who are either inferior or who are a threat. The pirates in the novels may be Phoenician or Egyptian, but the heroes speak and act Greek all the way through, reminding us of the graffito that we came across in Ptolemaic Egypt, where a man complained in his petition that he was mistreated because he didn't speak Greek. Okay, this is an exclusive world. When Clitophon is captured, he complains to the gods that he cannot even talk to his captors. In what language should we implore them, he says. So these novels reflect a world in which there is a clear linguistic barrier between Greeks and non-Greeks. Kings and courts, interestingly enough, do not figure very much in the romances. This, I think, is a particularly interesting aspect of the novels, because we've spent a great deal of time in this series talking about the various Hellenistic dynasties, and we've seen how tight the control of city life and village life and country life was in the hands of these Hellenistic kings. And yet in the novels, there is very little evidence of this. One doesn't come across Seleucus or Antiochus or Ptolemy or Attalus. Instead, the power, the human power, not the divine power, but the human power that people run up against is usually that of pirate chiefs and brigands. And in fact, many of these pirate chiefs and brigands, these robbers, actually refer to themselves as kings. Their little pirate fleets and their robber bands are a kind of inversion of the world of the Hellenistic court. Now, what are we to make of this? Well, for a start, I'm sure that it does mean that the vast majority of people in this world had no actual experience of the king. This was a superhuman figure who lived hundreds of miles away and from whom they might receive decrees, but about whom they knew nothing practical. They didn't know the king at all. And I think it suggests that for many people, their resistance to authority, a phenomenon we understand well in this country where people are often suspicious of government, this kind of suspicion in the Hellenistic world was often focused not on the actual kings, but rather on their negative image, the kinglets, the princelings, the bandit chiefs, who model themselves on Hellenistic kings, but really represent a just more bald tyranny over the lives of ordinary people. The novels, therefore, present a view of the Hellenistic world which I think is unique and valuable for us, because it's a view of the Hellenistic world as seen from the bottom up, that is to say, from the point of view of the Greeks, not the most powerful people at court, but the Greeks who saw themselves above Egyptians and Phoenicians and Babylonians, but below the power of their own kings. These are people who are caught in a world where power is capricious. They're caught in a world where law is a joke, which is enforced by the strong to the detriment of the weak, and where fate, circumstances, are always ready to dump on you. You are the plaything of fate. So it raises some interesting questions about the nature of community, about the individual and his or her place in relation to the society around him. The community exists, but the world of the romance is one of scared and vulnerable individuals. These are people for whom life is a constant battle and a threat. I think finally what we get in the Hellenistic novels is the nearest thing to something sitcoms and TV dramas in our own world. That is to say, they give us an idea of the way life is, although it's not an exact replication of life, it's an artistic rendering of it. And the concerns that we see in these novels, the interest in sex, which is often somewhat prurient, paralleled by sculptures that we've described on earlier occasions, the fear and the anxiety over fate, the contempt felt for anything which is non-Greek, and the suspicion that power is really coercive and is not there to represent us but to compel us. These are the kinds of themes that emerge in the novels and which give us, I think, a view into a world that was really quite familiar and remarkably like our own, a world in which the individual was not very secure, not very happy in his own position. The lasting influence then of these novels is that they give us both a view of the world and they also give us an idea of the individual psychology of people in the Hellenistic age. And for that reason, if you haven't read any of the Hellenistic novels, I would strongly urge you to go out and buy one.